This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Anyone can be a blogger, but not everyone is a real climate scientist. Dr. Alan Robach is an environmental professor at Rutgers University. He's a fellow of the American Meteorological Society and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He did participate in the Nobel-winning 2007 report of the IPCC. Dr. Robach, you've gathered a list of 20 reasons at one point why geoengineering might not be such a good idea. Now we know the climate is already in trouble and nobody has reduced their carbon emissions. Have you changed your mind?
I've been looking at the items on my list and I've canceled out a couple of them upon further investigation, but I've added one to the list. So my list now has 17 reasons why geoengineering might be a bad idea, 6 reasons why it might be a good idea. And to make decisions about whether indeed to proceed, we need to evaluate and study each of these issues in much more detail and quantify them to see how important they are.
Let's get into the solution now popularized in the media by Bjørn Lomborg, the Danish political specialist who created the so-called Climate Consensus Center. Their report on geoengineering says we can make clouds whiter really cheaply to cool the planet. What is your response to their report by J. Eric Bickle and Lee Lane?
I wouldn't say they've popularized it. I'd just say that they issued this report, which was not peer-reviewed, not checked by other experts. I wrote a comment on it on the realclimate.org website, which is a website done by real scientists, as you mentioned, and I pointed out that theirs is a purely economic analysis and looking at the costs of actually implementing schemes to make clouds brighter near the surface of the Earth or to put particles up in the stratosphere to block out the sun. And they're comparing that to the costs of reducing carbon dioxide emissions and the benefits of avoiding climate change. But they ignore a huge number of potential risks and the costs associated with them. And by ignoring a large part of the problem, they get a completely erroneous ratio of cost-benefit to cost for doing this.
And just out of personal curiosity, would it actually make the sky whiter? Would I lose my blue skies and end up with white skies?
Yes, that's number 4 on my list.
Okay. All right, well then
How white the skies would be requires more research, and it depends on, first of all, we should sort of define what we mean by geoengineering. These schemes to reduce the amount of sunlight reaching the Earth, so-called solar radiation management. I think that's a great term because it sounds so audacious that we can manage solar radiation. So I like to use it because it sounds ridiculous. But there are two schemes that have been proposed. One is to make clouds brighter near the surface by putting particles into them. That wouldn't make the skies in the upper atmosphere white at all. You'd still have blue skies above these clouds. The other scheme is to actually put particles up in the stratosphere to scatter sunlight, just like volcanic eruptions do. That would make the skies whiter. And to determine how white it would be, we need to know what types of particles, what their sizes would be, and where they would be in the sky, what time of year, what latitude, and then we could actually calculate what the sky would look like. And on my list of things to do is to turn this over to some psychologists who can evaluate how that makes people feel and whether that really depresses people. This blue color of the sky is something that our human race has lived with for many, many generations, and it's something that makes us feel good, and so to just eliminate it might really have important psychological effects. We know that in places where it's gray and dreary in the winter, like Seattle, the suicide rate goes up, so it's not something just to throw away. It really needs more evaluation along with all the other things on my list.
Well, I know how it makes me feel. It makes me feel angry just to think about it, but there you go. Well, we have a second more serious entry with the press release and a 100-page report from the Royal Society now in Britain. It also seems to champion the development of more geoengineering. What do you make of that?
I wouldn't say it exactly like that. What they say is we need more research in geoengineering. They don't say we need to do geoengineering. They say we need to understand it more, and I completely agree with that. The American Meteorological Society has also issued a policy statement about geoengineering saying the same thing, that if policymakers are considering this action to save us from global warming, they want to see, well, nobody advocates actually doing it unless there's a planetary emergency, unless things get out of hand and mitigation doesn't work. And so do you have this plan B in your back pocket? That's the question. Is there anything in your pocket or not? And so in order to answer that question, we really need a lot more work. And that's what both the Royal Society and the American Meteorological Society here have advocated.
Well, Alan Robach, you've written about the things that worry about geoengineering, and I know we won't have time to go through all of your reasons, but I'd like to give you some time now, as long as you like, if you could outline some of the biggest reasons to be cautious about technological fixes to the climate disruption problem.
Well, I've looked at the scheme to put particles in the stratosphere, and I've worked on the effects of volcanic eruptions on climate my whole career, and so first of all, we don't know how to do it. There are ideas, speculations using airplanes or artillery, but nobody's demonstrated that it could be done. And so a lot more work needs to go in just to the technology to see whether it actually can be done in a practical sense. But if it could, then we learn from volcanic eruptions that when you block out the sun, it cools the land more than the ocean. It doesn't cool the earth evenly. And in the summer, this temperature contrast between the continents and the ocean drives the monsoon circulation and produces rain over Asia and Africa, and farmers use that rain for agriculture. With geoengineering, this temperature contrast would be less, the land wouldn't heat up as much, and the monsoon would be weaker and there would be less rain. We find that in our climate model simulations. We also find that in observations, it's happened after large volcanic eruptions in the past. And so the food supply for a couple billion people that live in India and China and the rest of Asia is of great concern, and we don't know whether it would have a large effect or a small effect. It needs more evaluation with specific scenarios of geoengineering and different climate models that do things differently to compare to see whether this result is robust, but that's one concern. Another concern is that if you are trying to cool the climate, you will do nothing about the half of the CO2 that goes into the ocean every year that we put in. It makes the ocean more acidic and destroys coral, and so that wouldn't address that part of the problem at all. We also know that when you put particles in the stratosphere, they serve as surfaces for reactions that release chlorine and destroy ozone. This happens every year in the spring around Antarctica, and after volcanic eruptions, it happens at lower latitudes because of the chlorofluorocarbons, the freons that we've been putting up for decades. Although we're no longer emitting them, they're still going to last for many more decades, and so calculations have shown that geoengineering by stratospheric particles would cause enhanced ozone depletion and more ultraviolet radiation. One of the main ways that we're trying to solve the problem of global warming is to produce electricity without burning fossil fuels, and one of those is solar power. The most efficient way to use solar power is to focus the sunlight and boil water or concentrate it on a solar photovoltaic system. But if you put particles in the stratosphere, you'll have a lot more diffuse light. That's what makes the sky white, and much less direct light. And so that would really cut down on solar power. After the Pinatubo eruption in 1991, solar power from these systems in California that already exist was cut by 30% in the summer. Then there's a whole bunch of other things on the list. If it was stopped immediately by society losing the means or the will to do it, you'd get rapid warming as the particles came out of the atmosphere in the next year or so, much more rapid climate change than you'd get if you'd done nothing. And sometimes it's the rate of change of climate that's much more important than the absolute amount because we slowly adjust. Now, you know, Donald Rumsfeld was right about one thing. There's unknown unknowns. We don't know what we don't know. There could be human errors. There could also be unexpected consequences. And so we're always taking a chance by using something, this technological fix. It's easy to think of examples of technological systems that don't work properly. I mean, everybody that drove their car today probably wore a seatbelt, not because they expected to have an accident, but because just in case. So we know that we all intimately understand that concept. We all have insurance on our houses, so we understand that there can be mistakes. Now, who would be actually doing this? Would it be the U.S. military? Would it be ExxonMobil Geoengineering Corporation? their concerns about who would be in control and whose interests they would have at heart, and would they be trusted by people in our country and the rest of the world. And then let's assume that actually it could work, though. Let's assume, what if you actually could control the climate? Whose hand would be on the thermostat? Who would decide what the planetary temperature should be and whether we've actually reached a planetary emergency? There are no international governance mechanisms to control that. What if Russia and Canada wanted it a couple degrees warmer and India wanted it a couple degrees cooler? Who's going to decide? Will there be geoengineering wars? And, you know, astronomers spend billions of dollars to put these fancy observatories on tops of mountains, like in Chile and Hawaii, to get above most of the gook in the atmosphere so they can see the stars more clearly. If we end up putting a permanent layer of particles above these astronomical observatories, it would really have a huge effect on their operations. I don't think they would be happy with that. So I'll stop there.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960 KKGN San Francisco. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest is Alan Robach, a top climate scientist. We're talking geoengineering. Is there a lot of debate going on between our top climate scientists on whether we should go ahead with this? I mean, one of the points that you brought up is,
it depends what you mean by going ahead. I don't think there's much debate at all that we should go ahead with research to try and figure out if it could work and how it would work. People are doing this already, even though there has been no organized research program sponsored by the U.S. or British or any other governments. I expect that to appear sometime soon, and I have a research grant from National Science Foundation to study this. And so I don't think there's much debate about whether we should do the research. Some people say we shouldn't because it's evil, or that once you start developing it, you can't stop it from being used. But I don't think there's much debate about research. There are some people that are already advocating actually implementing it, that we're going to have a planetary emergency. As you said, there's no mitigation yet, and so we're going to have to use it eventually, and we might as well get started and do some small-scale experiments. And so there is a lot of controversy about whether you should ever actually do the experiment in the atmosphere and what it should consist of. But as far as actually learning more about it, I don't think there's much debate. I was on the American Meteorological Society committee that wrote the statement, and there was a lot of interaction, discussion among the people, but it was mainly about wording. It was not about the fundamental issue of whether we should recommend more research.
Well, I do worry about the research. It seems we got our nuclear knowledge, and we ended up making mass murder weapons out of it. And this climate control could be used as a military weapon. I think that was one of your points originally. And we've hardly had a technology as humans that we haven't that we've been able to resist using. It does worry me.
Yeah. Well, but nuclear bombs were built to be used as weapons. That was the fundamental goal. Later on, they said, well, maybe we could use it for nuclear power and make it look, to get some benefit out of it, but it was specifically designed as a weapon. So this is not specifically being designed as a weapon. And whether it could actually be used as a weapon or not is really an issue, because could you actually control where it would be? It looks like, from our understanding, that you can put particles in the stratosphere, but the wind blows them around the world, and you can't change the climate in one specific place and not in another place. And so, indeed, any knowledge can be used for evil. So that's the problem with knowledge. I mean, should you try and make your research as useless as possible so nobody could use it for good or evil? It's not specific to this or anything else. I mean, I think hand in hand with knowledge, we have to give some guidance and look at clearly give the negative as well as the positive aspects of it so people can decide. I mean, I was involved in nuclear winter research, and still am, the climatic effects of nuclear war, which is the biggest threat to the planet from humans, not climate change, not global warming, from greenhouse gases. And I'm convinced that our explaining the possible consequences on climate of the use of weapons helped end the Cold War and the nuclear arms race. It made people start looking at how crazy it was to continue to add more and more weapons and how dangerous it would be to use them. You couldn't even use them. And so if we educate people about the consequences, then they can make informed decisions.
Well, I'm also a bit suspicious because I find there seems to be two different bodies who are proposing more research into this. One is scientists who I would recognize, you know, like James Lovelock, who are saying we should do more research into geoengineering. But another seems to be coming from right-wing lobby groups, from even perhaps people funded by the oil industry, who seem to be suggesting, well, sure, we can keep on burning carbon. We may not even need to do very much at Copenhagen because we'll just geoengineer our way out of it, the big technical fix.
Yeah, well, that's a concern of mine, too. And I see these right-wing groups who, up until very recently, claimed global warming didn't exist. There was no problem. Now they're already suggesting a solution to a problem they claim doesn't exist. And as you said, there's this moral hazard problem. The prospect of geoengineering working would reduce the drive for mitigation. Not that there's much of a drive for mitigation anyway. The U.S. Has done nothing over the last 10 years, and finally we have a president and a Congress who wants to do something about it. They're still fighting huge interests in the energy industry, who still has lots of control about whether that we can actually reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases. And until the U.S. starts to lead, the rest of the world has an excuse not to do anything. And so if the prospect of geoengineering working appears to be real, it might lessen the drive for mitigation. But there are no responsible scientists saying that it should be geoengineering instead of mitigation. We all say that we have to do mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions first. And then if we can't do it fast enough, maybe temporarily we would have to cool the climate until we get the climate under control by mitigation and by taking the CO2 out of the atmosphere. And so it depends exactly how you say it, but there are people that are advocating geoengineering instead of mitigation. But those are sort of crackpots and not serious scientists advocating that. And so it's some people get confused by advocating geoengineering research as compared to advocating geoengineering. And so it has to be explained clearly to people.
And is it possible to test it without risking damaging the climate?
It depends which type of geoengineering you're talking about. The idea of putting particles into clouds and making them brighter can be tested on a small scale. You can choose a small area of the ocean, a remote area, and you can see if you can pump particles in and for an hour or a day and see how clouds respond and stop, and the effect will dissipate. That part of it can be tested, but putting particles in the stratosphere can't be tested on a small scale, even though some people claim that it can, because if you put a small amount of particles in the stratosphere, the winds will blow them around the world and dissipate them and diffuse them, and whatever effect they have on sunlight will be very small, and you wouldn't be able to measure it against the background of natural variability of the weather and climate, the chaotic nature of the atmosphere. In fact, nature has done this experiment for us a couple times in the last couple years. The Sarachev volcano in Alaska erupted earlier this summer, putting about 1 teragram of SO2 into the stratosphere. That's about 1/20th of the amount of the big eruption of Mount Pinatubo in 1991, which did have a measurable effect on climate. The Sarachev eruption nobody's been able to measure any impact on climate. It was a pretty large amount, but it was dissipated quickly. Last year, the Kasatochi volcano in Alaska erupted 1.5 teragrams of SO2. Again, no detectable effect, even though we could see the cloud. And so in order to do an experiment that would be large enough to see the effect, the signal versus the noise, you'd have to either do a huge amount for a short period of time or a small amount, but for a long period of time. And by then, you're actually doing the geoengineering. So I think experimenting in climate models in computer programs that have been tested by their ability to explain what's happened in the past, by their ability to model the effects of volcanic eruptions, is the way to test it now, not to do it in the real world, because we should do as much theoretical testing as we can before we actually do any in-situ tests.
Well, you touched on my final objection, as it were, which is that it seems like this is being proposed and developed by the elite, shall we say, in the developed world, and we have no mechanism for the average person in Chile, for example, to vote or decide. There's no global voting system where humanity can decide whether to change the sky. And I just find that a real fundamental problem. And I know that some people in developing countries see the same way?
Well, first of all, I would think that a lot of people in Chile would not say that they're a developing country. That's a pretty developed country. But second of all, the AMS statement, the American Meteorological Society statement, advocates research not just in climate but in governance. And so one of the three points that we make is that we need to research moral issues and governance issues and develop a new system to make decisions like that. And so we're advocating exactly that, trying to figure out how to make those decisions should the time come. And so you're right, there is no mechanism now. On the other hand, it's the rich countries that produced the problem of global warming in the first place. And so it should be incumbent on them to try and help find a solution, but it should be the whole world deciding. There's another issue. Do we really have the right to control the climate? And we're just one species. We have the right to control it for all the rest of the species on the planet. I mean, we're already having huge impacts inadvertently. We're not trying to change the climate. We're trying to drive our cars and cook our food and turn on lights. But now that we recognize that, we have the right to continue to do that. So there's a lot of these philosophical, moral issues that have to be addressed, which aren't being addressed either. The fundamental problem is that people make lots of money with business as usual by selling products that pollute the atmosphere with no sewerage charge, and we don't pay the actual cost of them. And they've gotten in the U.S., for example, the cost of gasoline should be $10, $15 a gallon if you want to pay for the military to bring in the fuel, if you want to pay for the environmental costs, and they've been successful at getting those costs paid separately without a connection to the use of the fuel. And so until we have an increase in the price of carbon of emitting it, there won't be much of a move on mitigation, and there are huge industrial interests in not changing that. So that's going to be the big fight.
Well, as we wrap up, can you give us a short summary that an ordinary citizen might take home about this debate for now?
Yeah, first of all, humans are, with their pollution, are causing global warming, are causing climate change. It might be hard to imagine, but the largest cause, there are many causes of climate change, including the sun and volcanic eruptions, but right now, what we put in the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels is the most important cause of climate change. And it's going to be bad for us. There's a lot of more losers than winners. And so the most important thing we have to do is to stop emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by using energy more efficiently and by generating energy with solar and wind power that doesn't produce CO2. That's the most important thing. If at some point in the future climate gets out of control and some future governance mechanism determines that we have a planetary emergency, we should know whether it's possible by some much cheaper method to actually cool off the planet, and would those mechanisms do more good than harm? And we don't know that yet, so we really need research just to know whether we can do that or not.
Our guest has been Alan Robach. Find more of his writing at the blog Where Real Scientists Speak, realclimate.org, or just Google Alan Robach, R-O-B-O-C-K, and you'll get his homepage top of the pile. Alan, thank you so much for giving us your valuable time and insight.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, and I'm still hoping we will make it peacefully through the eye of the needle to keep the natural Earth. You cut your emissions, and I'll cut mine. We'll dedicate ourselves to real solutions. We can't take this one lying down on the couch. Demonstrate you care on 350 Day. That's October 24th, 350.org, for the action nearest you.